ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You know, beloved listeners, when I started doing this program well over 30 years ago, it coincided with the first Western invasion of Iraq. And on that very first program, my very first guest was a bloke who became a dear friend in Christopher Hitchens. And we were joined as one in opposing it. But 20 years ago, at the time of the second war on Iraq, Christopher had utterly and profoundly changed his position. He became a wholehearted supporter of that war. Another of the early supporters was Robert D. Kaplan, a journalist who reported on foreign affairs for The Atlantic for three decades and who had witnessed the horrors of Saddam's reign of terror. Realizing his own mistake spurred Robert to think deeply over the following years about the delusions of the West, about leadership and about the nature of tragedy. The result is a remarkable book, The Tragic Mind, Fear, Fate and the Burden of Power. And Robert, we welcome you back to the Little Waters program for the third time. Can you start by telling us more of your experience in Iraq as a foreign correspondent? Because it was not pleasant.
Yes. First of all, it's a great pleasure to be back here with all of you. Iraq was never an abstraction to me, like it was to many other people in Washington and London and elsewhere. I knew Iraq intimately, both during Saddam's rule and after Saddam's rule. In fact, there was a time during one visit in 1986 when I was with pro-Saddam Kurds in northern Iraq, where my passport was confiscated for 10 days. And in a place like Saddam Hussein's Iraq, that's pretty scary. And what I saw in Iraq was a regime that was far more oppressive than any I had known, with the possible exception of Nicolae Ceausescu's Romania. It was much worse than Syria. People put Syria and Iraq together as two Ba'athist regimes, the Assads in Syria, the elder Assad who died 23 years ago, and Saddam Hussein. But actually, there was a difference. In Syria, you could say what you thought. You could travel around on buses all by yourself. You could file stories on your own, as long as you didn't announce the fact on a soapbox that you had questions about the regime, you were fine. Saddam's Iraq was much different than the elder Assad's Syria. Saddam's Iraq was like a large prison yard lit up by high wattage lamps. The population was totally repressed. You couldn't file stories on your own. a diplomat, a Western diplomat, even said to me, if the regime gets it into its head that you're suspicious, there's nothing any of us diplomats can do for you. So it was as if the Western diplomats were hostages to the regime, just as the population was. So I said to myself, to cut a long story short, what could be worse than this? This is so bad, nothing could be worse than this. And that led me to support the invasion. When I went back to Iraq in 2004 with the Marines and again in 2005 embedded with the U.S. Army, I saw something that was worse. I traveled around Al-Anbar province. This is March, April 2004 with a Marine battalion and culminating in Fallujah during the first of two great battles there. The first of in April 2004, which I witnessed, and then a much bigger battle in November 2004. And what I saw was anarchy, the battle of all against all, which was far more frightening than Saddam's Iraq. Anarchy is something that foreign correspondents have experienced in parts of Africa, other parts of the world. But the intellectuals and policy elites have no idea of anarchy. They know about tyranny because dictators are always in the news. They read about them all the time. But anarchy is something that they don't know much about. And it was far, far worse.
Yeah, so, well, you quote, I'm not sure of the source, thus, yeah, that 1 year of anarchy is worse than 100 years of tyranny.
Yes, that was made by a medieval Persian philosopher. It's an obvious exaggeration. 1 year isn't as bad as 100 years, obviously. But the point was, the context of his remark was that anarchy is worse than tyranny. And so I realized my mistake. And, you know, to learn about anarchy and tyranny is something the great philosophers have written about for thousands of years, from Plato to Hobbes. But to actually learn about it in a real life experience in Iraq was life changing for me.
I think we trivialize the word tragedy by overuse, by citing it, you know, on almost any time of misfortune. So can you tell me what tragedy is and what it is not?
Very good question. First of all, tragedy is not common misfortune. The rule of life is if we live long enough, we'll have bad experiences, we'll lose loved ones, we'll make mistakes. Common misfortune is normal life. That's not what the Greeks and others meant by tragedy. Tragedy is, it's basically having to choose not between good and evil, because that's an easy choice, actually. It's choosing one good over another good that causes suffering. Tragedy is about the narrow choices we face, however vast the landscape. It's about comprehension. Not to think tragically is to rob life of its significance. It's to comprehend your mistake when it's too late to affect the outcome.
When we use the word tragedy, we almost invariably think of Greek tragedy. And you make the point that in Greece, order is always a virtue, no matter how imperfect that order.
Yes, that's true. See, the Greeks were wise enough to know that the world was imperfect, but also beautiful. And they valued order above all else, because the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, were too rational not to understand that there were parts of this world that were irrational, that lay on the other side of rationality. And the irrational world was governed by anarchy. So because they knew that anarchy was the worst thing imaginable, they valued order. But they also realize that the world is imperfect and order itself has its problems. The founders of the American Revolution argued about this all the time. They wanted a new order, but they did not want that order to be tyrannical. So to make a long story short, is order is the first priority, and only then do you go about making that order less and less tyrannical.
Another central point in your narrative involves hubris.
Yes, arrogance. The Greeks, particularly Sophocles, and particularly in the play Oedipus the King, basically had a moral. And the moral was that no matter how beautiful and charmed your life is, no matter how wealthy you are, Oedipus was the king of Thebes, a horrible fate can befall you at any moment. So you're really not lucky until you're dead. Because up until that point, you can face catastrophe on any day. And that is why arrogance is a form of idiocy, as I write in the book. And arrogance is hubris.
You also cite Shakespeare quite often. He seemed to have the same almost godlike view of what tragedy meant.
Yes. Shakespeare is particularly apropos. There was a great American classicist in the early and mid-20th century, Edith Hamilton, who said, "The great tragic writers are four, and three of them are Greek, Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides. The fourth, of course," she said, "is Shakespeare." And for instance, Macbeth, where everything happens very quickly, there's no thinking, there's no ruminations, all these terrible events happen quickly. And that's why Macbeth cannot comprehend himself. He cannot comprehend the damage he is doing. And also in Hamlet, Hamlet is all about comprehension. It's all about not acting. It's the opposite of Macbeth. It's all about thinking deeply, but overthinking problems all the time. And Shakespeare, too, knew that, tragedy is something very exalted.
You cite a number of leaders that have embodied this tragic sensibility. The first two, I understand and wholeheartedly agree with, that's FDR and Abraham Lincoln. First, let's talk about FDR and his tragic sensibility.
It's very simple with FDR. FDR gave massive amounts of aid to a mass murderer, Joseph Stalin, in order to defeat another mass murderer, Adolf Hitler, because FDR knew this was the only way that you could win World War II in the European theater. So, imagine today if the U.S. gave aid to a mass murderer to defeat another mass murderer, the media would be up in arms about the moral imperfection of the policy. But FDR had a real tragic sense, even though he emanated optimism, which was part of his genius. He also had a deep tragic sense of how a tragedy is about terrible binary choices that you have to make.
I can see the argument for Lincoln. It's overwhelming and obvious, but I'm puzzled by your inclusion of Dwight Eisenhower.
Yes, Eisenhower was the first president who had hundreds of hydrogen and atomic bombs at his disposal during the Cold War and did not use them, even though there were several points during his presidency when his advisors recommended that he use them to defeat the Chinese off some islands in the South China Sea. They recommended that he intervene in Europe during the Hungarian Revolution. And Eisenhower said no. He was a model of restraint and caution. He had a tragic sensibility because he had experienced World War II. He had designed D-Day, basically. He led the Allies in the European theater. And because he knew what war was viscerally, and he understood the terrors of atomic weapons, his presidency, for the most part, in foreign policy was a matter of restraint.
And of course, when he left office, he made perhaps his finest observation, warning the world of the military-industrial complex. I'm talking to Robert D. Kaplan, who's the author of a fascinating book called The Tragic Mind, Fear, Fate, and the Burden of Power, published by Yale University Press. Do you think America's current policy elite have trouble thinking tragically?
Yes, they do, as a whole. And that's because, it's a generation of people who have basically grown up under prosperous economic circumstances and who have never seen or experienced war or mass violence in any way. I find that the best reactions I'm getting to my book are not from the policy elite in Washington, but from fellow foreign correspondents who have experienced war, or people in the military who have experienced war. That said, let me say that I think, this is going out on a limb a bit, that President Joe Biden's policy towards Ukraine does inculcate a tragic sensibility and is probably the most rational policy there is, which is give the Ukrainians lots of aid. Don't back down, but on the other hand, don't commit American troops. Do everything you can to keep the war from spreading to NATO countries. And always be worried about the Russians using weapons of mass destruction.
Certainly, the United States has recent experience of anarchy circling around the vortex of Trump.
Yes, absolutely. I think what the Trump experience has shown enlightened people is that even the United States, as blessed as it is by geography and a generally happy experience with mass democracy over 200 years, can suddenly fall into a trauma. You know, the system itself could be threatened, like Oedipus. One day you wake up and everything is turned upside down. You know, and that really is the symbolism of Donald Trump.
Now, you say that understanding world events starts with maps and ends with Shakespeare. Why?
Yes, what I meant with that was it starts with geography, with geopolitics, with natural resources, a country's position on the map and all of that stuff. But it ends with Shakespeare. And what I meant by Shakespeare was just with personalities, with the demons of personalities. So Ukraine is all about Ukraine's position on the map, and it's close to Russia, and the language is similar, and there's no natural border between them. But it ends with the personality and the demons of Vladimir Putin. So a great statesman has to understand both the Shakespearean reality and the geopolitical reality. They cannot be separated.
All honor to Shakespeare, but there are also modern writers that
yes.
embody this tragic sensibility, and you cite, among others, Dostoevsky, Conrad, and Camus.
And also Melville, Herman Melville, the American 19th century novelist. Yes, let me take Camus for a minute. I've selected all of these writers deliberately because they all embody a sensibility of the ancient Greeks and Shakespeare. Camus wrote a book called The Rebel, and it's about revolt. And he said it is in humankind's nature to revolt against authority, against oppressive authority. But then he said something very radical. He said, unless the rebel has thought deeply about a new order to replace the order he is rebelling against and has made plans for this new order, his rebellion is robbed of its moral significance. In other words, take Iraq again. Destroying, dismantling Saddam Hussein's tyranny is a good in and of itself. But if you haven't planned deeply and minutely about what would replace it and putting in place the things to replace it, it robs your invasion of moral significance.
If policymakers had adopted a tragic sensibility, if they'd read their Dostoevsky, their Camus, their Melville, their Shakespeare, do you think things might have gone differently in Iraq?
Oh yes. I think the stunning thing about Iraq is not the invasion itself. Because remember, in the months prior to the 2003 invasion, throughout 2002, it was a big year for terrorism worldwide. The administration was deeply worried about a second attack in the U.S., et cetera, et cetera. So it's not the invasion that's stunning. What's stunning is the lack of any real planning for what would come after.
Okay, so the fundamental lesson of the tragic writers is that anyone challenges a tyrant or a tyrannical state must have an alternative order.
Yes, they must have an alternative. It's easy to rebel, but it's hard to erect a new bureaucratic order. That's why, we see just in the last few hours and days in Sudan and in other places of the Arab world, the Arab Spring, we saw rebellions in Yemen for democracy, in Syria for democracy, in Libya for democracy, but they all fell into anarchy, essentially, because it's not enough to bring people out into the streets brought together by social media. That's easy to do. What's hard to do is to erect a new bureaucratic order of governance. That's the trick.
Is there a tragic sensibility in the way the West is approaching China, for example?
I'm afraid there is not enough of one. I notice in Washington now, everyone is a China hawk. You know, the one thing that unites the Democrats and the Republicans is that they're against China. There's something in me that rebels about that. You know, that China is the ultimate strategic challenge for sure. But I think what we have to do is to be afraid of war with China, to be afraid of war over Taiwan. That would tank, that would really destroy financial markets for one thing, as well as so many other things that would happen. We have to try to thread the needle to find a way to, you know, by thinking tragically and fearing a conflict with China and fearing how it could end up, we need to find some way to coexist, to manage the problem of Taiwan indefinitely.
In reading your book, we wondered whether the lack of tragic thinking explains the complacency when it comes to climate change. Is that the case?
I think it is the case, because in modern life, everything works perfectly. You know, we get up in the morning, we know what the weather's going to be, we check our iPhones, all of that. So there is this illusion of order, of perfection in the natural world. The natural world is taken for granted. But what if the natural world changed suddenly? Society, civilization itself would be upended. And because we see signs of the natural world changing, and too many people are saying, oh, that's tomorrow, that's in 10 years, that's in 100 years, we don't have to deal with that. Well, that's, that's a complete lack of a tragic sensibility. A tragic sensibility is to use fear constructively. You know, wise leaders are afraid, but they are not immobilized by fear. So fear is a good thing, provided you're not immobilized by it and you take constructive action to deal with what you're afraid of.
Robert, it's been great to talk to you. My guest has been Robert D. Kaplan. His day job is the Robert Strauss Huppe Chair of Geopolitics at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, and he finds time to belt out 20 best-selling books. His latest, which we've been discussing, is The Tragic Mind, Fear, Fate, and the Burden of Power, published by Yale University Press. Good on you, Robert.
Thank you so much for having me.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.